Welcome to Executive Insights and the Director's Letter. I'm Dan Daly, the publisher. And today I'm joined by a very good friend, an old friend, but not in terms of age, Stuart Cable. Stuart is a senior partner at the law firm Goodwin, operating out of their Boston office. He spends a lot of time in mergers and acquisitions, very much involved in their life sciences projects and that part of the practice. But also, he's also vice chairman of the entire firm, which now, Stuart, is what, almost 2,000 lawyers on a global basis. So Stuart is a very sharp guy, he's a very important guy, and he has condescended for some reason to meet with us today. So today what we'd like to do is really look forward based on Stuart's exposure to all types of companies, not just life sciences, but all types of companies. And as we look forward into 2024, why is it different than previous years? And what are some of the factors that make it different? And you, as a member of the board or a senior executive, what should you be worried about that perhaps you didn't have to worry about a year ago, 2 years ago? So the conclusion is, I think, and Stuart agrees to a limited extent, but maybe the same extent, that 2024 is going to come up with some unique challenges. Now, you may know already a lot of those challenges, but you may not know all of them. So that's what we'd like to discuss in our first session. Then I've asked Stuart if he would give a little free non-billable advice in terms of something which is the rolling strategic plan. A lot of companies have it. It sits in the general counsel office or it sits in the CFO's office and gathers dust. That's not going to cut it. So what is the strategic plan? What are the components of it? Where does the input come from? And how is it maintained and reviewed going forward? So that'll be our second session. So, Stuart, let's get started here. Let's talk a little bit from your vantage point. I want to look forward into 2024. I'm just going to go down some risks, and you can address them in the order. There is unionization going on, automobile, Starbucks, Kaiser Health. We appear to have somewhat of a slowdown if you're involved with electric vehicles. SEC, we want to come back on relative to private equity, the impact there of floating rates, IPOs. We had a couple of IPOs, Arm Holding and Instacart in the fall. We thought that might be a turnaround in the IPO market. They didn't do that well. So status of the IPO market. So those are some of the things that I'd like to have discussion. Anything else that you see out there that really come up to the idea of risk management for the individuals who are responsible for operating the company going forward?
Yeah, I'll take a cross-section of your ideas and try to group comments into a few observations about what I think is maybe the most challenging aspect for innovative companies today.
Right.
And that is capital availability.
Right.
Capital.
And really, every company today has to be innovative.
2024 and the back half of 2023 have been and will be decidedly different than the decade that came before.
I agree completely.
The decade that came before was an era of cheap money.
Yep.
Hugely available money. Bottom interest rates, free capital, huge availability of private equity money, huge availability of venture capital money.
Right, sure.
So what's changed?
Yep.
Well, one of the things that's changed is the interest rate environment.
Right.
And you might say, well, gee, Stuart, what does mortgage rates have to do with capital availability for innovative companies,
right,
technology,
right,
and life sciences? Well, shockingly, it has everything to do with capital availability, because when interest rates skyrocket, debt capital becomes less available and obviously substantially more expensive.
Right, right.
Not a little bit more expensive.
A lot.
When you go from 1 or 2% to 6 or 8 or 10%, that's a multiple.
Yes.
Okay? So debt availability is down substantially. Mm-hmm. That impacts not only the private equity market, because you know your ability to leverage your financing as a private equity guy goes down substantially. It also impacts the debt that public companies with us, right?
Got to pay more for it.
Convertible debt today, you know, 4, 5, 6%. 2 years ago, less than 1%.
Yep, right. Okay?
Even senior bank debt facilities, you know, 5, 6, 7%, depending upon the credit, versus 0.5, 1, or 2%, you know, even 2 years ago. But it's not just about cost of capital, cost of debt capital. It's more about availability of debt capital. So the
big
leverage buyouts that we were doing, you know, 2 years ago, I did Citrix, which was $16 billion. The banks lost hundreds of millions of dollars between the time that deal signed and the time that it closed in September.
And they're stuck with those.
2022, and they have to mark their debt to market.
Right, right.
So guess what? The whole public company recap world, the whole buyout world for tech companies essentially stopped.
All related to an increase in interest rates.
All related to an increase in interest rates, leading to less debt availability, lower multiples of debt availability, leading to lower prices being offered by big private equity funds to buy out these companies.
And a lot of the private equity firms, a lot of those that debt is variable. And that's a different game entirely. And a lot of times there are covenants in there that give the private equity investor a good whack at your company from an ownership standpoint.
Right. And it's not a tough deal. It's not just at the company level. It's also at the fund formation
level. Okay, good point.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, private equity funds raise billions and billions and billions of dollars every year. Fresh capital, dry powder. Venture funds do the same thing. Well, where do they get their money? They get their money from limited partners.
Right.
Who are, you know, pension funds and institutional investors, universities of all kinds.
Right, right.
And those people are looking at the yield curve and said, huh, would I rather invest my money at 5, 6, 7% with zero risk?
Right.
Or would I rather invest in this private equity fund or this venture capital fund? And the truth is that while those funds continue to be formed, fewer of them are forming, and they're smaller than they were 2 years ago. So the whole interest rate move has affected capital formation substantially in the back half of 2023, and it will continue almost certainly into 2024, unless we have a reset down of interest rates, which, you know, probably will be 2025, I would
think. Right, right. And it's not going to go down by 3 points in 6 months. It will not, my opinion is, it will not go down as fast time-wise as it went up.
Correct. Right. Now, what kind of companies does this impact most substantially? The companies that are impacted to the greatest degree are, and this may sound contradictory, the most innovative companies. Because the most innovative companies are, by definition, the companies with the highest beta and the highest risks. So it's those investment categories that have been most severely affected. And an example of that, with which I'm familiar, given what I do for a living, is the life sciences space, the biotechnology space.
Right.
There is no industry vertical that is got a higher beta than drug development, right? Your drug either works or it doesn't work.
Right.
It's not like, it's not like the private equity world where, you know, they're investing in ongoing cash flows.
Right.
So you look at the market, what company has had what industry's had the greatest difficulty raising capital? Where have stock prices come down the most substantially? It's been in the most innovative industries.
Right.
Biotech, software, although software's rallied nicely. The tech industry is still challenged, particularly at the early stage, because the early stage SaaS companies and software companies, they're not making money.
Right.
Okay. They have to be in business for 5 years.
And the investor and his investors or her investors want to see that you're producing product, and they want to see that the product is being sold at a profit. Yeah. So the old days of tomorrow will do
it. In the tech industry, it was a badge of courage to be losing money.
Right,
that's
right. If
you were losing money, that means you're not growing fast enough to invest the capital.
Hiring people, just fill those offices.
It's no longer a badge of courage to be losing money in software or in tech more generally.
Right.
And everybody understands.
WeWork, one of our favorites, is out of vogue.
Yes. Still operating in bankruptcy,
I know.
Decidedly out of vogue. It's very hard to kill a company of that size.
Right.
So we've talked about debt capital markets.
Yes.
Let me transition to equity capital markets, talk about the IPO market,
yep.
the follow-on market.
Please.
The private markets for VC and private equity money. Let me start with public companies. IPOs had a brief flurry of activity in the August, September, early October range. Then for some microeconomic reasons and some macroeconomic reasons, most notably that those companies did not trade particularly well, the IPO market has quietly closed up again. Now, that is not to say that companies are not busily working on IPOs. They are. When the market opened up again briefly in September, we had a flurry of activity, and we're still having a flurry of activity with companies that want to prepare to go public.
Right.
And unlike in the old days when you filed your IPO, today IPOs are done almost all the time on a so-called confidential basis. So we have dozens of IPOs filed confidentially.
Without documents out in the public sector.
Right. The documents are with the SEC.
Right, but not now.
We're turning the documents with the SEC. We're looking to clear the SEC. But if we go and when we go is the business of the company.
Right.
It's the business
of
the board of directors. And it is not publicly known.
Right.
I will tell you there is a long queue at the SEC. The SEC is still in business, they're clearing IPO prospectuses quietly. So when it opens up, it could open up in a very significant sort of way.
Providing the buyers are out there.
Providing the buyers are out there. And I don't think that is unrelated for the reasons we've discussed previously.
Absolutely.
To interest rate trends.
Let me interrupt you for 1 second. Now, the company is saying, well, we're going to do this IPO. We'll do it in Q1. In the meantime, they may be running out of money. And this alternative of the IPO in Q1 may be their life ring, but it may not happen. So if you're on the board and you're concerned with risk management, what is your alternative if that Q1 IPO doesn't happen and you run out of money?
Well, the last IPO surge, which ended kind of two-ish years ago. But ran for 5 years, at least, prior to that, kind of in the, 2015 to 2020 time frame. That world evolved, particularly in the last couple years, to the point where almost all IPOs then were preceded by what we call crossover rounds. A crossover round is a private investment.
Like a mezzanine round or something like that.
It's a private investment in equity, which take place 3 to 6 months before the IPO itself.
Right.
And it usually involves some of the existing investors, but new investors too, who want to get in at a price marginally better than the IPO price. So I would predict, past being the best prologue to the future, I would predict that when the IPO market does resuscitate, what you will see is a bunch of crossover rounds being done in anticipation of the IPO market happening. And because the IPO market is so challenging right now, the preeminent investment banks, the Goldman Sachs, the Morgan Stanleys of this world, the JP Morgans of this world, they are almost always recommending the crossover round before the IPO because it reduces their risk, right?
Okay.
They see like-minded institutions coming in at the crossover round. They have an opportunity to test the market. You know, they can test the market through what are called test the market meetings as part of an IPO process.
Right.
But they can also effectively test the market by doing a crossover round.
Would you have private equity firms come in on those crossover / mezzanine rounds?
In general, no.
No, okay.
Crossover rounds are generally done by public investors. Oh. Public investors, including the big mutual funds, have an ability to invest in private companies.
Okay.
And so they invest in the private company as a precursor to the public offering. The company has to give, you know, some assurance that the company will go public.
Mm-hmm.
They can't give legal assurance,
but they
talk to the bankers, they talk to the management team, and they become persuaded that the company will become public. Maybe it's 3 months, maybe it's 6 months, who knows? But for a price break, they will come in a private round prior to the public offer. So you will see crossovers start to happen as a precursor to the IPOs happening. Sticking with equity capital markets for public companies, follow-on public offerings are being done. We are getting some of those done.
Mm-hmm.
Convertible debt deals are getting done.
Mm-hmm.
Interest rates on convertible debt deals are modest by historical standards, but higher than what they would have been, significantly higher than what they would have been a year or 2 years ago.
Okay. All right.
But those kinds of public equity deals are getting done, both follow-on straight equity deals and convertible deals, but they're getting done on less advantageous terms. So straight equity deals in the follow-on markets have always been done at a discount to what the trading price is.
Right, right.
For a whole variety of technical reasons. Those gaps, that discount that the companies are getting is bigger today, it's wider today than it was 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you might have done a follow-on equity deal at a 5% discount to the close 2 years ago. Today it's more like 10 to 15%.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more dear, but it's doable. IPOs, really not, absent extraordinary circumstances, not executable. The bankers, there will be no IPOs, for example, in the life sciences sector until after JP Morgan in the second week of January, and then only if things start to improve.
Now, you're talking about relatively sophisticated instruments for raising capital. I mean, we haven't even touched on the traditional bank loans. That's just not around anymore and won't come back? Or, I mean,
no. Bank loans are still available. Both term loans and revolvers are available. They get done every day. But highly leveraged loans and, you know, major recaps at 6 and 7 times cash flow,
not going to happen.
Not happening. Are some deals getting done at lower multiples with lenders? One of the important things that's happened in the lending market, in the big deal lending market, is the advent of what we call private lenders.
Yes.
So for years, these deals were financed by the banks.
Right.
And
now, I'm going to interrupt again. Forgive me. Private lenders, same as private equity?
Different people.
Yeah.
Same idea.
Oh, same idea.
So
okay.
Private lenders, you know, someone like Ares, A-R-E-S.
Right.
A well-known private lender. And there's dozens of private lenders out there. And basically, they are a subspecies of private equity, I would suppose, because what they're doing is they're raising big funds from LPs. They raise money in much the same way.
Now, they're putting in debt. Are they getting equity also?
They're getting kickers occasionally.
Kickers, okay.
But they're not generally taking big equity positions.
Like the private equity people, okay.
Right. The private equity guys, you know, are still either doing majority private equity deals, or in some cases they're doing growth equity where it's a minority position.
Mm-hmm.
The private lenders, almost all of their juice comes from interest rates or... Right. Fees.
Now, am I correct? I was reading something from the SEC that they are going to be focusing in 2024. They did to a lesser extent in 2023, but in 2024, they're going to be focusing more on some of what I'm calling broad brush, this private credit. And, you know, that could impact my ability to even get this private credit if the SEC, or maybe I don't want it if the SEC is all over that firm.
Well, I would say Washington in general, but not just the SEC, the Federal Reserve, Congress, everybody is looking at what is often called in Europe a shadow market, right?
Right.
You know,
shadow lending, yeah, yes.
Meaning that regulators can't easily see what's happening.
Right.
Because it's happening in the shadows.
Yes.
Of private equity, private debt.
Yeah, private lending, all this.
You know, if the banks are putting out the bulk of the capital,
yeah,
you know.
You can look at it.
The government sees that every day. They don't see it in the private market. And
that bothers them.
It bothers them. And, you know, the SEC and others are looking for more disclosure from private equity funds.
Right.
They will look for... The Federal Reserve Board is going to look for more disclosure from private debt funds because they can't really monitor the economy with the same degree of detail that they can when the bulk of the capital is coming.
So if you're a board member and you're the CFO of a major corporation, you've talked very in a very detailed fashion about all of these options. But if I'm a company, I can't say, well, Stuart says they're great. We've got five options out there. You have to look and see what the status of those options are and their applicability to your company. Otherwise, you're kidding yourself.
Yeah, and, you know, there's no right answer.
No.
Every situation is situational. But for public companies, they're looking more to private debt than they looked to public debt in the past. They're looking to different providers instead of looking to the banks exclusively. They're looking to hedge funds. They're looking to private debt providers. They're looking at private equity. So capital formation, both for public companies and private companies, is way more complicated.
Complicated and demanding.
More options in some sense, because
there are
more players in the game, but fewer simple options
than
was the case,
and
particularly in a highly leveraged
Let's end on that note, because I think that's critical to board members, the audit committee, the finance committee, the CEO and the CFO, is yes, there are more options, but don't necessarily assume that they're all available to you. So here's your list of the options. How many are available to us, and what do we have to look like and sound like and present like to qualify options 1, 2, and 3, but not 5 and 6? I mean, this gets down to reality and risk management. And if you're sitting around the boardroom and somebody's very vociferous, they're saying, not a problem with all these things, somebody's got to be there and say, wait a second. Let's find out more about these products. Let's bring in people like Stuart and Goldman or somebody like that and talk about what are they, what are all the nuances, and what's the risk involved, and are they applicable to our firm? You don't want to find that out after the fact.
Well said.
Okay. All right, my friend. We're going to stop there and come back, and Stuart is going to help us a little bit reviewing your rolling strategic plan, and obviously it will encompass some of the topics regarding liquidity that we've been discussing here. So stay with us, please. So thank you very much.